Northwestern University presents the Reviewing Stand, a national radio forum in its 11th year on the Mutual Network. Today we discuss the question, fact and fiction in psychiatry. What can psychiatrists do in a time of conflict? Does psychiatry have anything to tell us today? These are the issues. You can participate in these weekly discussions in two ways. Listen to the facts and opinions of the speakers. Read the printed word-for-word transcript of the discussion. $1 will bring you these pamphlets for the next 26 weeks. $2 for 1 year. 10 cents for a single copy. Write to the Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, or to the Mutual Broadcasting System, Chicago, Illinois. Irving J. Lee, Assistant Professor of Public Speaking, Northwestern University, is the moderator of today's discussion. Mr. Lee.
The crises of our time, of war and the making of the peace, of juvenile delinquency, black marketeering, strikes, and all the rest, these crises involve people. You and the radio audience have written again and again to say that people must learn to think straight, that if only we keep our heads, maybe something can be done about these troublesome problems. This week, in Chicago, some 2,500 members of the American Psychiatric Association meet to think and talk about this business of thinking and behaving. And I'm indeed happy to welcome to the Northwestern University Reviewing Stand microphone four distinguished psychiatrists to raise some questions about the role of their professional activity in this time of crisis. Dr. Carl M. Bowman, president of the American Psychiatric Association and director of the Langley Porter Clinic at the University of California. Dr. Daniel Blaine, director of the Neuropsychiatric Service of the Veterans Administration. Dr. A.E. Bennett, professor of neuropsychiatry at the University of Nebraska. And Dr. S. Bernard Wardis, director of Bellevue Psychiatric Hospital and professor of psychiatry at New York University. Well, Dr. Bowman, what is a psychiatrist and what does he do?
A psychiatrist is a doctor of medicine. That means he has gone to medical school for 4 years. In addition, he must have had a general hospital internship of 1 year, and after that, he must have had 5 years of special training and experience in the problem of mental disease in order to qualify him as a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist is concerned with the problems of mental sickness and mental health. He is a doctor primarily, and he follows the same approach to these problems as do doctors everywhere in these problems of health and sickness.
I wonder whether it wouldn't be wise to tell the radio audience a little more clearly what some of the problems are he deals with. For example, the psychiatrist is concerned, as Dr. Bowman said, with emotional illness. That means behavior disorder, problems of delinquency, personality maladjustments, instabilities, anxieties, and a whole host of conditions where emotional stress causes physical symptoms and physical illness.
Dr. Wettis, I'd like to add one more thing. I think the whole general subject of happiness and contentment comes into this problem very strongly.
Well, what are the kinds of... Let me ask another question. Does everyone who needs psychiatric care get it today?
By no means. Psychiatry takes care of the major emotional illnesses quite well, but society's commonest illness, namely the minor emotional illnesses producing physical symptoms, are badly cared for. Over 50% of the patients who consult physicians are really suffering from minor emotional illnesses.
How widespread is psychiatric need today? Dr. Wardis, do you have any data about how widespread?
Well, we have some estimates on this problem. It is estimated that in the United States today, there are probably about 650,000 to 750,000 persons in mental hospitals requiring help. But this is by far the smallest part of the job. There are better estimates indicating that approximately 6 to 7 million people in the United States today could profit from proper psychiatric care.
Does that include the veterans, Dr. Blaine?
Yes, the veterans come in this general figure. Actually, Those figures that Dr. Wardis gave come to about 6% of the population. Veterans are about a third of the adult population. And they have more or less the same problems. I don't think we can distinguish between the types of problems. They are exactly the same.
Well, why aren't people getting such treatment?
They're not getting it in the first place because we do not have adequate facilities for giving them good psychiatric care in our state hospitals and other hospitals. And secondly, we do not have enough well-trained psychiatrists. And third, there are many things we don't know about mental illness for which we need research. It gets back in many ways to two points: the apathy of the public, and second, the lack of money.
But, Dr. Bowman, the general hospitals of this country have not assumed their proper responsibility. About 90% of our general hospitals will exclude a known psychiatric patient, although about 20% of the patients in those hospitals really belong under psychiatric care, are basically mental illnesses.
I think you're absolutely right on that, Dr. Bennett. And one of the things that we should do is insist that general hospitals be general hospitals in fact, and not simply exclude the mentally sick. They should take them in as well. They are sick people and belong in general hospitals. And the sooner we do that, the more the general medical profession will be interested in this problem, and the better care the patients will get. And we'll also remove some of the stigma of commitment, which now prevents many people from getting care.
Dr. Bowman, you'll be interested. You probably already do know that the Veterans Administration has actually started in this direction. We have approval now for about 30% of our beds in general hospitals. Medical and surgical hospitals will cease to be that. They'll be called general hospitals and will include psychiatry for treatment in all of them.
You know, there's another side to it. It seems to me many general hospitals also should take it upon themselves to care for the person who is alcoholic. Recent estimates have made it clear that if about 3% of hospital beds of the country were allocated for this purpose, the poor alcoholic wouldn't be living most of his life in jail.
Well, and what about the cost of getting psychiatric care and treatment? Isn't it excessive? We've heard so much about that.
Well, as far as the individual doctor is concerned, it does cost a good deal, because a psychiatrist can see relatively few people in a day, 8 or 10 perhaps at the most, if he sees them any length of time, as he has to do. But, Dr. Bennett, you can tell us about the hospitals.
Well, within a few weeks, excellent results are being obtained in up-to-date hospitals with modern therapy. But in the past, long-standing chronic cases of patients come often too late, and after the mental illness has become fixed and the patient has gone the rounds of quacks, cultists, and so forth, and other illogical procedures. Of course, this is very expensive, and by the time he reaches the psychiatrist, his finances are usually exhausted, and any further treatment is too expensive.
Dr. Bowman, you said something about superstitions keeping people away.
That is true. There are many ideas which people have about mental illness which are untrue and unfortunate. First, the idea that all mental disease is inherited. This is not true. Secondly, the idea that there is some special disgrace or stigma about mental illness. There is no more disgrace about being mentally sick than there is about being physically sick. It is unfortunate that we have archaic methods of commitment which make commitment a legal process and which make the poor patient in the status of an individual accused of crime. And as long as we do that, we're going to keep many people from going to hospitals and getting the mental care which they need until it's too late. And that is why, as we said before, the problem of putting mentally sick people in the general hospital without commitment procedures, as is being done in many places now throughout the country, is one of the solutions to the problem.
One of the problems, it seems to me, that the public should help with is that, you know, the American population is getting older each year. More people are living a longer time, and therefore more of them are becoming subject to hardening of the arteries of the brain. It always seems a pity, it appears to me, for a family to have to send the old father or mother or uncle or aunt to a mental institution when really what they need is a home where they'd be given some reasonable care. That means we need special facilities, it seems to me, for the care of the old people. In addition to that, if there were funds available, much research could be done in how to avoid the aging process, and that would keep a lot of people out of hospitals.
Yes, and Dr. Wirtis, 14 states still do not have a voluntary admission act, and patients naturally resent having to go as legally committed people.
Well, our state hospitals, how good is the quality? is the service which people get in state hospitals as bad as the recent article in Life magazine would have us believe?
We all know that the care being given patients in the majority of our state hospitals is inadequate. Psychiatrists have been saying this for many, many years, and we have been arguing and pleading for more money and more facilities. This is not a new discovery as far as psychiatrists are concerned. It apparently is for many of the public. The public have been apathetic toward the problem. They don't want to face it. They don't want to do anything about it. They don't want to spend any money. They say it is too expensive to furnish good psychiatric care. However, I would say that as long as this nation spends over $7 billion a year on alcoholic beverages, we need not be too concerned on spending up to perhaps $1 billion, as we do at the present time, on the problem of mental disease. It seems to me that is much too little for us to spend in proportion to what we are spending, say, on alcoholic beverages. And when we see all the misuse of public funds and the wastage of it, I say that we should siphon off some of that money toward the care of the mentally sick, towards research in the problem of mental disease, and really do something about this problem.
I would like to suggest that money is not the only answer. Perhaps a somewhat of a change of the present system should be considered. For example, most of our mental hospitals are isolated in the country. They're away from medical centers. And again, speaking for the Veterans Administration, we are hitching up our hospitals to teaching centers. And we believe that much better treatment of patients will occur where teaching is going on, and you have young fellows beginning to stimulate the older men and keep them on their toes.
I thoroughly agree with what Dr. Blaine has said, and all of us in psychiatry with medical schools are in complete agreement with the Veterans Administration in its effort to put hospitals in connection with medical schools. The former policy of putting them in isolated parts of the country where good medical service and consultation is not available has been very bad. And we all of us want to heartily endorse the attitude which the Veterans Administration has taken to bring the psychiatric hospitals back in close connection with the medical schools and medical centers of the country.
I think a word should be said also for the fact that the Veterans Administration is doing a superb job with the training of psychiatrists. They are making it possible for young men, bright young men, to go into this field by taking them in the service, giving them an excellent training of over a period of at least 3 years, so that the American veteran will be getting a lot better psychiatric care.
Is there some...
I'd like to say here that if it weren't for the cooperation of the medical profession, and particularly the psychiatrists and the schools, the Veterans Administration wouldn't get first base. So we want to thank them here.
Is there any medical legislation, or is there any legislation on the books, or pending at the present time, to provide more money for psychiatric care?
Yes, you know, the United States government, and especially also the public health service of this country, is much interested in this problem because they recognize that it is the biggest problem that concerns the health of the country. And quite recently, the United States House of Representatives passed what was called the Priest Bill. And there is at present up in the Senate its companion bill, Senate Bill 1160. The main purpose of this bill is to establish a national neuropsychiatric institute, or a national institute for mental health. Also, this institute would concern itself largely with research into the prevention, cause, diagnosis, and treatment of psychiatric disorders. They also have in this bill provision to appropriate federal funds for the purpose of furnishing financial aid to states, counties, and localities to enable them to initiate adequate preventive mental health facilities and to train qualified personnel throughout the country. And the administration of this program is vested in the Surgeon General of the United States Public Health Service and in the National Advisory Health Council. This bill, incidentally, at present before Senate, should receive the enthusiastic support of every American citizen.
Well, now, you're talking about dealing, about treating emotional difficulties. I'm eager to know whether you psychiatrists think anything can be done to prevent mental and emotional difficulties from happening in the first place. Is it possible to do any mass attack on the development of alcoholism, nervousness, etc., that you listed before? Dr. Bennett?
Unfortunately, prevention is still the most neglected field in psychiatry. It probably will be the most important subject in the future. Mental hygiene societies to stimulate interest and inform the public about mental illnesses, child guidance clinics, teams of psychiatrists, psychologists, and social worker in public schools, better counseling and occupational guidance in schools are showing results in this field. With the same energy and intelligence shown by the workers in tuberculosis, the same results in prevention could be obtained in the field of mental illnesses. The lack of personnel, such as psychiatrists, psychologists, and psychiatric social workers, is in part responsible for the small work done in preventive psychiatry.
Well, Dr. Bennett, even if there were enough people, you mean that psychiatrists know enough about how to prevent mental difficulties?
I think so. In some respects, we know a great deal. The relationship between the faulty home adjustments, parental relationships, and childhood development, and all that sort of thing, could finally prevent adult neuroses. I would like to say, however, that there is so much that we don't know that the most important thing at the present moment is to get started on adequate research. Research costs money. We need some way of financing that research. And one of the ways to do that would be to set up a national mental health drive along the same lines as is being done with tuberculosis, infantile paralysis, and cancer.
You know, it's a funny thing, Carl, but the funds that are available for other types of illness, for research in them, are awfully much larger than what we have available for mental illness, which seems to be the largest job in the country. For example, every case of infantile paralysis has available a little over $100 for research on that particular case. Every case of heart disease has a fair amount of money available for research. And every case of mental illness has proportionately only about 25 or 30 cents available for research. Now, just think how silly that is, because we certainly have on our hands as an American people the care of the mentally ill, which is the largest medical job facing us today.
I don't think we ought to wait for research to start. And I believe that we need something that should be going very shortly. We know, for example, a good deal about the nature of fear, and we learned a great deal about anxiety during the war. And if every person in the country knew enough to understand himself and how he would react when he became scared, that alone, just that one simple thing, would be a tremendous help.
Well, how can we get that, Dr. Blaine? How can such information be made available?
I think it should be made available in a more wholesale way than before. And it shouldn't be attacked on two broad lines. It should be should be restricted to the things that we are really sure about, because psychiatry cannot cure all human ills. It's too complicated. But there are a good many things that can help, and I think that...
Certainly, what you mean, Dan, is that with regard to problems like behavior disorders in children and delinquency and crime, we have already accumulated enormous amounts of information concerning many of the factors that are related to it. Certainly, most of the kids that come up for delinquency and crime in our juvenile courts have come from broken home situations, and from situations at home where the father has not been, or the mother, have not had an adequate amount of time to devote to this child so that the child could be properly trained to recognize the restraints that society will later impose on him.
Well, how does that psychiatric wisdom trickle down to most of the people? That is, if psychiatrists have it, how do you get it away from psychiatrists?
Psychiatrists are delighted to pass it down the line if they only have the opportunity to do it.
You mean in a private office?
I think that this much should be said, that psychiatrists really have been entirely too content to deal with private individuals and patients and haven't really lived up to their own responsibility to see that the nation knows a great many of these things.
Well, is there any organization that psychiatrists know about concerned with public education?
There is one organization which is concerned primarily with that. That is the National Committee for Mental Hygiene, which is an association set up almost entirely for educational purposes, to try to bring these facts before the public. And the National Committee for Mental Hygiene has a great body of literature which it is willing to send to those who write for it and to advise them about what is necessary and what can be done in these matters. They are, I think, the organization which is really competent to deal with this, and they have been, to the best of their resources, doing an excellent job.
Somebody ought to tell this audience the address of that association.
Anyone can obtain material by writing the National Committee for Mental Hygiene, 1790 Broadway in New York.
At New York City.
Right.
Well, a minute or two ago, Dr. Bowman, you indicated that there was need for more and more research. Did you mean to say that there were not new developments, new methods of treatment, new ways of solving emotional difficulties being developed?
No, they're being developed all of the time. Psychiatry is making a great deal of progress, and we can point with pride to many things which we have done in the last few years to get better treatment for mental patients.
I'd like to have some of those names specifically.
Well, on the physical side, the introduction of artificial fever therapy has been a great advance. Medical and nutritional regimes for acutely delirious patients, vitamin therapy, and so forth, have improved our treatment of organic illnesses.
I don't think these people know what you mean by I don't think they know what organic means. You better tell them.
Can you do that quickly, Dr. Bennett?
Well, the organic brain diseases, toxic delirious states, or actual infections of the nervous system, such as syphilis. In the functional emotional illnesses, psychotherapy, psychological re-educative treatment, in some cases psychoanalytic investigation, hypnoanalysis or chemical hypnosis used in the war cases have all been effective for minor emotional illnesses, commonly called the psychoneuroses.
What are some of those? That is, you mean you can use this battery of complicated techniques on some of the everyday kinds of worries and fears that Dr. Blaine and Dr. Ward have talked about?
The minor emotional illnesses, the anxiety states particularly that Dr. Blaine emphasized. And then the shock therapies of more recent origin are very effective in treating and relieving better than 50% of early acute cases of our major functional emotional ill patients. Then many other modern therapies, such as psychiatric nursing, occupational, recreational, educational activities, and so on.
I think that the greatest and most important advance was learned when the war came on us and proved to us that by far the greatest burden of the psychiatric problem is connected with the milder things and not with the more serious things which we spend our time on. And so we have learned a great deal more about personality adjustment.
Well, Dan,
and that's where the real skill and advancement
Dan,
has come.
Dan, didn't the experience of the Army and Navy indicate several important factors? One was that a much larger proportion of people could be helped than we thought of before the war if you treated them early enough and actively enough. Isn't that so?
I think it's so, and I made a statement before which some people might criticize, but I think that for a person of over 30 or 35, that a serious condition in psychiatry has a better prognosis than any other serious medical condition. It can do more for them.
You know, for the audience, I think you ought to say prognosis means outlook
for
cure.
Well, the outlook for cure. After all, if you get heart disease, lung disease, kidney disease, you can't cure them. They just have to put up with them the rest of their lives. But we can actually cure these things in mental conditions in a large percentage of cases.
Now, gentlemen, you've been talking about individual difficulties, about small family unit activities. But the headlines of our newspapers the last 3 days have to do with some large-scale problems. Strikes, for example. Some of the smaller headlines indicate that we aren't out of the strike business at this moment either. Racial and religious prejudice, mass conflicts of all sorts. What have you psychiatrists to say about the big problems? Do you have anything to say?
I would say first that mental health of the nation is synonymous with mental health of the individuals. If you can solve the emotional problems of the individual, teach him how to deal with life adequately, many of these mass problems will not arise, or when they arise, the people will be able to deal with them adequately. And one of our big troubles is that people have not been taught to think clearly, to face their problems frankly, understand what are the emotional factors really back of their unrest. And until we do that, we are going to have much difficulty arising in society without people being aware as to why they're acting and thinking and feeling the way they are.
Well, are you gentlemen optimistic? Note what you've said, that these kinds of big difficulties respond to treatment, but we also have few psychiatrists and few people able to deal with them. Do you see an impasse, or are you still optimistic about what psychiatrists can do?
I'm very optimistic about it, because we have evidence, again, from the war experience, That morale building, which was really a good psychiatric job, well done, reduced casualty rates. Also, there is evidence from units where psychiatrists have worked in industrial plants and in industrial relations that morale problems are better, and also the opportunity for people to learn to get on to with each other well and interpersonal relations can be very well smoothed out.
Because we've worked as individuals with individuals. Now, group therapy has come along, which is an expansion of the of the skill of one person to a larger number of people. Frankly, I don't think that even that alone is going to catch up with the problems with the speed of the world. We've got to get some form of, almost you might say, a mass treatment. But I don't want anybody to think that we know what that is yet.
Well, since we have just a few moments left, I should like to ask Dr. Bowman whether, as a result of the issues that we've raised here, there are any recommendations that you think you'd like to make, which you'd like this audience to support.
Yes, there are several. Time prevents my going into all of them, but I would like to emphasize the following points. First, we feel that the general hospital should take psychiatric patients. Second, we believe that we should provide better care in our state mental hospitals, that this is the responsibility of the public, and that their apathy is largely to blame for the present conditions in state hospitals. The doctors have known this for a long time. We must set up better living conditions, more adequate pay, and better buildings in our state hospitals. But remember, after all, that brains, not mortar, is what will provide good care for our mentally sick. Third, we need more support for research in psychiatry. Fourth, we need more psychiatrists, and the general practitioner in medicine must learn to pay more attention to emotional factors in illness. Finally, we should have a national mental health drive like that of tuberculosis, infantile paralysis, and cancer, which will serve to educate the public and will also bring in funds for training of psychiatrists, for providing research, and for providing better care.
Can we look to the Psychiatric Association to deal with any of these things?
Yes. The psychiatrists are doing everything possible to deal with this, but we cannot do it until the public stands back of us.
Are there efforts being made to interest the public in some of these questions?
Yes, there are, such as the National Committee of Mental Hygiene with its campaign for publicity, and all of the work which psychiatrists as individuals are doing and appearing before public health places and before the legislatures of states and before the public generally, trying to put these facts before them.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bowman and gentlemen.
Thank you, gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to the Northwestern University Reviewing Stand discussion, Fact and Fiction in Psychiatry. We invite you to subscribe now for copies of the Reviewing Stand weekly discussions. $1 for the next 6 months, $2 for an entire year. A printed copy of today's discussion may be purchased for 10 cents in coin. Write to the Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, or to the Mutual Broadcasting System, Chicago, Illinois. Participating as guests today were Dr. Carl M. Bowman, Dr. S. Bernard Wartis, Dr. A. E. Bennett, and Dr. Daniel Blaine. Our moderator, Dr. Irving J. Lee, will now tell you about next week's program.
Next week, we discuss the question, Industrial Disputes and the Judicial Process. Guest speakers will be Leon Green, Dean of the School of Law, Roland Posey, Dean of University College, and Elmo Holman, Professor of Economics, all of Northwestern University. We invite you to listen.
This program has been a public service and has come to you from Chicago. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.